The last train of the night smells like the city at the end of itself. Cold metal, stale air, the ghost of a thousand commutes that nobody remembers making. Tony Smith walks the length of the last car at the end of his shift the way he has walked it for 6 years, checking seats, checking corners, looking for the ordinary wreckage the city leaves behind when it empties out after midnight. Forgotten bags, sleeping men who miss their stop, the small evidence of lives that don't stop moving, even when the trains do. He almost misses her. She is in the far corner of the last car, folded into herself like a woman trying to take up no space at all. Coat pulled tight, head down, shoulders doing something small and controlled. The movement of a person crying without sound, grieving in the smallest possible footprint, because she has already learned that this city does not widen for anyone's pain. Tony stands at the end of the car and watches her for a moment. He reads situations before he enters them. What he reads here is not danger. It is the specific bone-deep exhaustion of someone who has run completely out of places to go and is sitting in the last one left. He sits down across from her, not beside her, across, close enough to be present, far enough to give her room to breathe. "Miss, you all right?" She doesn't answer. Her shoulders do that small thing again. He waits. Tony Smith has always been good at waiting. It is perhaps his defining quality, the ability to hold still while everything moves around him, to not fill silence with noise the way most people do, because the silence makes them uncomfortable. He pulls out his phone and texts his wife, lady on the train, crying, staying to make sure she's okay. "Don't wait up." On the other side of Brooklyn, Wanda reads it, sets her phone face down on the nightstand, and goes back to her book. She knows her husband. The trust is so complete, it doesn't require a response. 20 minutes, maybe 25. The train holds both of them in its cold, flickering light. Then the woman lifts her head. The first word out of her mouth, "Tony knows." Before she finishes the syllable, he knows. The cadence, the particular music of it. The way Kingston opens its vowels and lands its consonants, soft and certain at the same time. It is unmistakably home, and something in Tony's chest unlocks that he did not know he had locked. 6 years in Brooklyn. 6 years of code switching and conductor's voices and being Tony Smith, the responsible man. And in one syllable from a stranger on a dead train, something older surfaces. He shifts into patois without deciding to. The way you shift into your mother tongue in a dream. And now they are not a conductor and a weeping stranger. They are two Jamaicans in a cold city at midnight. And that changes the geometry of everything. Her name is Janice. She is 24 years old. She came up from Kingston 3 weeks ago for a man who had been building her a life in New York, across WhatsApp messages for 8 months. Every night, a new promise. The specific language men use when they want a woman to believe in a future they have not actually decided to give her. She arrived at the address he gave her. She knocked. The woman who answered had seen Janice's face before, in different versions, and was tired of it. The man appeared in the doorway behind his woman and told Janice to leave. 8 months, every dollar she saved, all the hope she packed into two suitcases. She has been riding the trains ever since. Not because she has somewhere to go, because stopping feels like giving up, and she does not know how to give up, but she also does not know where to stop. Tony listens with his whole body, the way most people only pretend to. And while she talks, something is happening in him that he is not yet aware of. Not a decision, not even a thought. Something below thought. Something in the frequency of her voice. The unguarded way she is sitting in her own wreckage without trying to manage how it looks. He notices too, because he is a man and she is in front of him, that she is extraordinarily beautiful. Not assembled beauty, not performed beauty, the kind that is simply there, like weather, like light off water, the kind that exists without asking anyone's permission. He stops that line of thought, firmly. He is a married man. He says it out loud. "I'm married, have a family." She nods. She isn't asking him for anything except what he already offered, someone to sit with her in the dark. He buys a prepaid Visa card at the bodega near the station, withdraws $1,000 cash, loads the card, buys her a prepaid phone, gets her an Airbnb for 2 weeks. His name on the reservation, the prepaid card covering the trail, a clean address that he is already instinctively building without asking himself why a good deed needs a clean address trail. He drops her off, watches her go inside, sits in his car for a moment, looking at nothing. He drives home to the brownstone on Hendrick Street, the building he and Wanda bought together with 5 years of doubled shifts and no vacations and Sunday dinners at home instead of restaurants. He parks in front of it and looks at it the way he sometimes does, counting what he has. The habit of a man who came from not enough and built something real. 3 families, 2 rented, 1 theirs. He goes inside, eats the plate Wanda left warming on the stove. Rice and peas, chicken, covered in foil, the way she always covers it. He eats standing at the counter, not because there is any reason to stand, but because sitting down at the table feels like something a man does when he has nothing on his conscience. He has something on his conscience. He showers, gets into bed. Wanda turns toward him in her sleep, the way she always does, her body finding his without waking. Automatic, the habit of 10 years. And he lies there in the dark with her warmth against his side and stares at the ceiling and has the most honest conversation he will have with himself for the next 2 years.
What the hell are you doing, Tony? Not a question, a statement. He says it inside his head in the flat, direct voice he uses when he is not in the mood to be lied to, including by himself. He went and got a prepaid card, a prepaid phone. He booked a woman an Airbnb.
He sat with her for 25 minutes on an empty train at midnight and felt something he had no business feeling, and then proceeded to spend another hour solving her problems instead of walking away from the platform the way any sensible married man would have done. He looks at the ceiling. His wife is sleeping next to him. His son is down the hall. His daughter is in the next room. He built this, all of it. 5 years of doubles and sacrifice, and every unglamorous decision pointed in the same direction. And now he is lying in the middle of it, thinking about a woman he met 3 hours ago on a train. You need to stop this right now. He tells himself this clearly. Call it what it was, a good deed, nothing more. And let it be done. She has a place to sleep. She has money for 2 weeks. She's not your responsibility. You are done. He closes his eyes. He means every word of it. He is asleep inside 10 minutes. The morning moves the way mornings move in the brownstone. The kids up first, loud and immediate. Tony Jr. already in full conversation with himself about something that happened at school yesterday. Simone trailing him by 4 steps the way she always does. Wanda moves through the kitchen with the precise efficiency of a woman who has 17 things to do before 7:30. And has already mentally sequenced all of them. Tony drinks his coffee and watches his family and feels the full weight of what he has and what it cost to build it, and tells himself again, quietly but clearly, done. Let it go. It was a good deed. It's over. He goes to work. He runs his route. The morning crowds pour in and pour out at every stop, and he does his job the way he always does, present, professional, the machine running clean. He is fine. He is over it. He is a married man with a family and a life he is grateful for. And last night was nothing more than a moment of misplaced kindness that he has now correctly filed and closed. Then his phone buzzes on his lunch break, a number he doesn't have saved yet but recognizes. Hi, Tony. I hope I'm not bothering you. I was wondering if it would be possible when you have time if you could take me to get some groceries. No rush at all, just whenever. And thank you again for everything. You didn't have to do what you did. He reads it twice, puts the phone down, picks it up, reads it again. He types back, "Yeah, I can do that. After my shift." He stares at what he just typed for about 4 seconds. Then he puts the phone in his pocket. After this, he tells himself, starting the second conversation with himself of the day, "I'm going to be straight with her. Take her to get groceries,
Make sure she's set, and then tell her the truth, that I'm a married man, that I have a family, that I don't like lying to my wife, and that I can't be doing this. I was glad to help, but this is where it ends. She'll understand. She seems like a smart woman.
She'll understand. He believes this. He believes it through the rest of his shift. He believes it on the drive to the Airbnb address. He is still believing it when he pulls out his phone to call and let her know he's outside. She comes out the front door. Tony's train of thought stops like it hit a wall. She is wearing a sundress, fitted, floral, the kind of dress that knows exactly what it's doing on the body wearing it, and her hair is loose, and she is moving down the front steps with the natural, unself-conscious ease of a woman who is simply going to get groceries, who has not done anything deliberate, who just happened to put on that dress because it was a warm afternoon. She gets to the car and opens the door and slides in and looks at him with a bright, direct smile and says, "You like my outfit?" And she says it the way a woman says it when she already knows the answer. Not coy, not manipulative, just easy, just herself. The smile of a woman who is comfortable in her own skin and has no agenda, except to know that she looks good today. And it is nice that he noticed. Tony opens his mouth. He closes it. Everything he rehearsed on the drive. The I'm married. The I have a family. The I don't like lying to my wife. The this is where it has to end. All of it is right there, fully formed, ready to be said. He knows exactly what he came here to say. He came here specifically to say it. He says, "Yeah, you look nice." Or yes, and pulls out into traffic. They go to the market first. She moves through the aisles with the focused efficiency of a woman who knows how to cook and knows what she needs. And Tony pushes the cart and she adds things to it, and they talk the way they talked on the train. Easy, fluid, patois and English, sliding back and forth without seams. She asks his opinion on things he has no opinion on. He gives opinions anyway. She disagrees with two of them, and he can't tell if she's right or just convincing. Probably both. He is supposed to be having the conversation. He is aware at every moment that he is supposed to be having the conversation. He is not having the conversation. After the market, she mentions she is hungry, and he says there is a Jamaican restaurant not too far, Pepper Hot, a spot he has been going to for years, the kind of place that does not look like much from the outside and does not need to. They go. They order at the counter. Brown stew fish and rice and peas for him, oxtail and rice and peas for her, and they take the corner table, and the food comes out, and it is exactly right, the way food is exactly right in restaurants that have been making the same things perfectly for 15 years. She takes her first bite of the oxtail and closes her eyes for half a second. "Oh my God." Tony laughs. "The real kind, right?" And they are off talking about food, about Kingston food versus Brooklyn Jamaican food, about what survives the crossing and what gets lost in it, about their grandmother's kitchens and the specific dishes that exist nowhere in the world except in the memory of the people who ate them. She is animated when she talks about food, the way some people are animated about music, fully engaged, hands moving, face completely open. She makes him laugh twice more before the rice is half gone. He makes her laugh once, and she points at him like he surprised her, like she wasn't expecting it. And something in that gesture, the honest delight of being caught off guard by a person, lands somewhere in him that he is not able to immediately locate or remove. He is supposed to be having the conversation. He eats his fish and says nothing about the conversation. He takes her back to the Airbnb. Carries the groceries up, sets the bags on the kitchen counter. She starts putting things away, and he stands near the door with his keys in his hand, in the posture of a man who is leaving, who has decided to leave, who is actively in the process of leaving this apartment and this situation and putting it all cleanly behind him. "Thank you, Tony, really, for everything." "No problem. You good now?" "Yes," she turns from the counter. Looks at him, something easy and direct in her face. "Actually, are you working tomorrow?" He should say yes. It is his day off, and she does not need to know that. The correct answer,
The answer the man standing near the door with his keys in his hand should give is yes. No, he says. Day off. Whiz. She smiles. I want to cook for you. Proper breakfast. Ekki and saltfish. Fried dumplings. Fried plantain. Come in the morning. Frotoni looks at her standing in the kitchen of the Airbnb he booked with a card, opened at an address his wife doesn't know about, in the dress that has been quietly undoing him for the past 3 hours. And he understands with complete clarity that the conversation he came here to have is not going to happen today. It is not going to happen today because Janice has not done a single thing wrong. She is not pressuring him. She is not playing a game. She is simply a woman who is grateful and who would like to cook him breakfast. And if he says no, he will have to explain why. And the explanation will require saying all the things he rehearsed and standing here right now with her, looking at him the way she is looking at him. He cannot make the words come out. Yeah, he says, all right. And the moment he says it, the precise moment the word leaves his mouth, he knows, he feels it, the way you feel a door lock behind you in the dark. Not a click, not a sound, just the sudden understanding that the way back is no longer where it was, that he has crossed into territory that does not allow for an uncrossing. He drives home through Brooklyn streets he has driven 1,000 times and does not see any of them. The argument he has with himself on that drive is the most serious one yet. What are you doing, Tony? What the hell are you doing? You have a wife who trusts you. You have kids, you have a life. Turn this around right now. You can still turn this around, and every word of it is true, and he knows every word of it is true. But Janice has already gotten into him in the way certain people get into you. Not through strategy, not through manipulation, but through the simple, devastating power of being exactly who they are, at exactly the moment you are most susceptible to it. He is falling for her. He has been falling since the first word she said in Kingston Patois on the last train of the night, and he knows it now without the ability to pretend otherwise, and he is going to her door in the morning. He parks in front of the brownstone, sits in the car, looks at the building for a long moment. Then he goes inside, eats the plate Wanda left warming, showers, and gets into bed beside his wife. Wanda turns toward him in her sleep. He lies in the dark and stares at the ceiling and does not sleep for a long time. The conductor gloves sit on the nightstand, holding their shape, waiting. It is Tony's day off. He tells Wanda he picked up overtime, drives to the Airbnb, and knocks on the door at 6:30. She answers in a white t-shirt, thin cotton, washed soft and black underwear, hair loose, face clean. No performance, no preparation, just herself in the early morning, and she is more beautiful in this completely unstaged moment than she has been in anything he has seen her in yet. Tony stands in the doorway, one beat too long before he finds the words for good morning. The apartment smells like coffee and scotch bonnet, and ackee crisping and cast iron, and the smell reaches inside him before he has fully stepped through the door. He has eaten ackee and saltfish his whole life, but there is something about the smell of it in this kitchen, on this morning, in this borrowed apartment. It hits different, like the food knows something about what is about to happen, that he is still pretending he doesn't. Come in, she says. I cook. She has set the table properly. The ackee and saltfish is plated generous and confident, with fried dumplings golden on the side, and fried plantain laid out sweet and dark and exactly right. Coffee in two actual mugs. She has done all of this in a borrowed kitchen, and the care of it, the quiet refusal to do it any other way, even in these temporary conditions, tells him something about her character that settles into him like a fact. He eats two plates. She watches him eat with the satisfaction of a woman who knows she cooks well and has no need to announce it. They talk between bites, Patois sliding into English and back the way it does when two Jamaicans are fully at ease, the language shifting with the mood, the way music shifts with the key. She is funny, dry, precise, Kingston funny, the kind that lives in the understatement and the perfectly timed pause before the punchline. She makes him laugh twice before the coffee is finished. Real laughs, the kind that come up from below the chest, without asking permission. After breakfast, they move to the couch. She puts on Burris Hammond, then Buju, then something older that Tony recognizes from his mother's kitchen on Saturday afternoons. They talk for hours about Kingston, about their parents, about the specific textures of home that don't survive translation into American English. She talks about nursing, about Brooklyn College, about the program she has been researching since she arrived. She is not a woman who intends to be a charity case. She is a woman who got knocked sideways and is already calculating the angle of re-entry. And the intelligence and the self-possession of it hits Tony in a way he is not prepared for. He is falling. He knows he is falling. He watches it happen with the detached clarity of a man watching something expensive drop in slow motion. The arc is obvious, the landing is inevitable, and his hands are not moving to catch it. And then she is beside him on the couch. Not across, beside. Close enough that he can feel the warmth coming off her skin. Close enough to catch the faint scent of her hair. And she puts her hand flat on his chest, the way a woman touches something she has already decided belongs to her. He does not move her hand. The last honest thing Tony Smith says is, "But I'm married." "We geech." Janice says, "I know." What follows is not weakness, and it is not an accident. It is two fully conscious adults making a choice in a fully lit room, and they both know exactly what they are choosing, and they choose it anyway. Tony has been with one woman for 10 years. He loves Wanda. That fact does not disappear, does not get suspended. It sits inside him like a stone while the rest of him burns. But Janice, the way she touches him is like being touched for the first time by someone who learned him in another life and is simply remembering. She moves without hesitation. She moves like she knows the map of him. She is uninhibited in a way that dismantles every careful, composed, responsible thing he has been for a decade. She meets him without reservation, without performance, without the accumulated weight of real life pressing down on the moment. She makes sounds that he will hear in the back of his mind for the rest of his life. She says his name like it is a word in a language only the two of them speak. He thinks, God help him, he thinks it while it is happening and cannot stop, that he has never felt anything like this, not once, not with anyone. He knows, even as the thought forms, that it is the most dangerous thought he has ever allowed himself. It is not that Wanda has been inadequate. Wanda has never been inadequate. It is that this is something that lives in an entirely different room of human experience. A room he did not know existed, whose door he just walked through, and which he cannot unknow now. They spend the whole day together. The whole day. They don't leave the apartment. They make love in the morning, and lie tangled and talking through the afternoon, in the particular naked honesty that only exists after a line has been crossed. Talking about Kingston, about their childhoods, about the dreams they carried to this city, and what the city did to those dreams. He tells her things he has never told Wanda, not because Wanda wouldn't understand, because Wanda is his real life. And in your real life, you present the version of yourself that can carry the weight. With Janice, he is just a man, lying in a borrowed bed, talking in his mother tongue, and it feels like relief in the precise shape of a trap. She has 4 days left in the Airbnb. He hears this, and his mind moves to solutions before his conscience can catch up. Basement apartment, through a friend of a friend, $1,500 a month. Another credit card, different address, used to furnish the place properly. Good bed, couch, kitchen table, coffee maker, television. A job for her answering phones at a law office in downtown Brooklyn. Brooklyn College enrollment, nursing program, Tuesday and Thursday nights. He arranges all of it in 2 weeks with the efficiency of a man who is very good at solving problems and has decided, without examining the decision, that this is a problem he wants to solve. The basement apartment on Gates Avenue becomes, in his internal accounting, a practical arrangement. Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights, when Wanda works her double, he is careful, he is thorough. He has become, without naming the project, fluent in the management of a double life, and he has become, without naming that either, genuinely in love with Janice in a way that has no clean exit. 2 years pass, 2 years in which Wanda works her doubles, raises her children, runs her building, and loves her husband with a completeness that is itself the tragedy, because there is nothing conditional about it, nothing that gives Tony an excuse or a grievance. She is fully, wholly his wife. He is systematically, carefully betraying her. Miss Yvette notices something. She notices the way Tony sometimes looks at his phone and looks up with a smile that is slightly wrong for the room he is in. She notices the way he volunteers information about where he has been before anyone asks. She files it in the archive of a woman who has seen this shape before and knows where it ends. She says nothing. She watches. Tony Jr. is 6 now. Simone is 5. They are becoming people, opinionated, specific, loud in the ways that fill a brownstone with the kind of noise that Tony would lay down anything to protect. He is still a genuinely present father. He still reads to them at night. He still falls asleep on park benches, watching them run themselves breathless. The crack in the foundation is not visible from the surface. It is only a crack. The building is still standing. At Janice's apartment, the life they have built together has its own texture now. She is deep into the nursing program. Quick, disciplined, eating the curriculum alive. She has friends at school. She has a life that is genuinely hers. She has Tony on the scheduled nights. Warm, funny, fully present when he is there. Bringing food, finishing the Netflix series, falling asleep on her couch on Wednesday nights, and leaving before the sun comes up because Wanda's double ends at 7. The sex has not diminished into comfortable familiarity, the way he perhaps half expected and half hoped for. Something that would reduce the whole burning thing into something more manageable. It has deepened. 2 years in, and he still reaches for her with the same urgency as the first morning, and she receives him with the same complete unguarded openness. And what lives between them in those hours is something he has stopped trying to categorize. But he is not there on the other nights. Not there on her birthday. Not there when she gets a grade back and needs someone to celebrate with. Not there in the way that a real partner is there, present in the ordinary, unglamorous minutes that make up most of a life. Janice is 26 now, not 24. The 2 years have moved on her faster than they moved on Tony, because that is how time works differently on the person who is waiting. She wants a baby. She wants a life with a real center. She has been building something here. Nursing school, a salary, a future, but the building has a structural absence at its center, where a full partner should be. She has been telling herself it is temporary since the ackee and saltfish morning. She has stopped believing it. It is Wednesday night, Chinese food containers on the coffee table, Netflix playing to a room where neither of them is watching. Tony is loose and warm and not thinking about tomorrow. Then he mentions the doctor's appointment. Simone's, Thursday morning, early. He has to leave tonight instead of in the morning. Janice goes quiet, not the comfortable quiet of two people at ease, the quiet of something gathering pressure beneath the surface, looking for a release point. Then she says it, not as a hypothetical, not with the softening language she has used before. Plainly, directly, in the patois, they share. The language that does not leave room for polite evasion. She wants a baby. She wants more time. She is tired. She puts weight on that word that makes it carry the accumulated cost of 2 full years, not one night's fatigue. She is 26 years old, and she is in love with a man who goes home to another woman every night. And she needs to know when that is going to change, because 2 years have passed, and she needs to know. Tony hears this the way men hear the thing they have been praying. The woman they love would never say directly. All at once, with no buffer, he has no answer that is both honest and painless. He says things that are not quite promises. He says, "Let me think," which means he will not think about this. He says, "I hear you," which means he heard her and is hoping the topic has now been addressed without actually being addressed. Janice looks at him, She is not naive. She has not been naive since approximately the third week of this arrangement. What she sees in his face tonight is not a man about to make a decision. It is a man buying time, and she is out of the patience required to let him do that. She says everything she has been holding for a year. All of it, without editing. He gets up. He leaves. She lies alone in their bed and cries into the pillow in the silence of a woman who is finally, honestly, allowing herself to know what she has known for a long time. The kitchen drawer in the next room holds its silence. The next day, Tony texts her brief and cool, doesn't come over. The day after, the same. A week passes in which the architecture of 2 years shows its weakness for the first time, still standing, but the crack visible now to anyone looking. Janice is looking. She opens the kitchen drawer, finds the business card, Calvin McKenzie, consultant. She tells herself she just needs someone to talk to, someone from before Brooklyn, before the basement apartment, before she became the woman waiting on Tuesday and Wednesday nights. Calvin knew her when she was simply Janice from Kingston. They were together 3 years. And yes, he broke her heart, but he also knew her. And right now known feels like what she is hungry for. She texts him, "Hey, stranger." He responds in minutes, warm, unhurried. He asks how she is doing. Doesn't press when she says fine without meaning it. Within a week, they are talking every day. What Janice is choosing not to examine, what she selected not to look at back in Kingston and is selecting not to look at now, is what Calvin actually is. In Kingston 13, his name is spoken carefully. He ran with a crew the community called the Ridgeline Boys, and the expensive clothes and the business card and the Brooklyn address are a new coat of paint over a history that does not change because you moved cities. She knows this somewhere below the conscious level, the way the body knows things the mind has not approved for acknowledgement. She keeps that knowledge below the surface. She is using him as a container for feelings she cannot bring to Tony. What is wrong with that? That is the question she asks herself. She does not wait for the answer. The Vibes Cartel concert has been on the calendar for 3 months. June 15th, Barclays Center. Janice has held this date through the rough weeks, since the argument like a small, steady light. The sure thing, the thing she and Tony planned together, the thing she has looked forward to with the specific intensity of a woman who has learned not to look forward to things too much and is trying to unlearn that. Tony calls the afternoon before to tell her they can't go. She already knows before he finishes the sentence. She has learned to read the particular rhythm of his voice when Wanda is the reason. He confirms it. June 15th is Wanda's birthday. Dinner reservation. The kids at Wanda's sister's house. The rare night the brownstone is just the two of them. He can't cancel it. He's sorry. He'll make it up to her. She hangs up. She sits in the apartment in the dark. Not because the lights are off, but because she pulled the blinds and didn't turn anything on, and the dark feels accurate. 3 months she has been carrying this concert. 3 months. It has been the thing she was going to give herself. And now she is in the dark on Gates Avenue, while Tony Smith takes his wife to a 5-star dinner on her birthday. Her phone pings. Calvin. She tells him. He offers to take her. He has an extra ticket. He was going to go anyway. Come on, you shouldn't miss it. Nothing inappropriate in the offer. Nothing she can point to and call wrong. She says yes. On June 15th, Tony puts on his good jacket and picks Wanda up from the front door of the brownstone, because she deserves to be picked up from the front door on her birthday. They go to the restaurant she chose, white tablecloths, candles, the kind of place that requires a reservation 3 weeks in advance. Wanda is in the blue dress. Her hair is done. She is happy the way she is happy, when her life is working, her husband across the table, her children safe, the night quiet and entirely theirs. She reaches for his hand across the table. He takes it. He is thinking about Janice, approximately a third of the time. He knows he is doing this. He hates that he is doing this. He also loves the woman across the table from him, with a genuine, rooted love that has not died, and these two truths coexist inside him like two frequencies, playing simultaneously, dissonant, exhausting, unresolvable. Wanda deserves all of him tonight. She is getting most of him, and she doesn't know the difference, because she has never had reason to suspect there is a difference. She goes to sleep happy. Tony lies beside her and listens to her breathe. At the Barclay Center, Janice is in the crowd when Cartel's first song hits, and the room becomes exactly what it promised. 20,000 people connected through bass and memory and the specific electricity of a Jamaican artist in a building full of diaspora who needed this release. She is on her feet. She forgets for stretches of 4 and 5 minutes every calculation and deferred decision. She is inside the music, which is where she has always been most herself. Calvin is easy beside her. He takes up exactly the space he is given, and no more. Doesn't push, doesn't reach for her beyond the ordinary closeness of a crowd. He is simply present, and tonight present is enough. After the show, they go to a spot in Crown Heights, wood paneling, red light, a chalkboard menu of Jamaican food that is exactly right at 1 in the morning. Oxtail, rice, drinks. They are laughing, genuinely, fully, the belly kind, and it has been a while since Janice laughed like this, and she notices it and tries not to think about what it means. A man at the bar, 2 tables over, recognizes her face from Tony's world. He watches them for a few minutes. He takes a picture. He dials. Tony is home. Wanda is in the bathroom. He picks up without checking the number. 30 seconds. Janice's name. Calvin's name. The address. Then the picture arrives on his screen before he has time to manage his response to the words. What happens inside Tony Smith in that moment has no rational name. He has no standing for what he is feeling. He knows he has no standing, and knowing it does not reduce the feeling by 1 degree. It is something older and faster than rational standing, the visceral animal response of a man who built a private world around a woman and is seeing that world contain someone else. He is dressed before Wanda comes out of the bathroom. She finds him in the bedroom doorway with his keys in his hand and a look on his face she has never seen, not the family man face, not the nightlife face, something tight and fast and pointed somewhere she cannot see. Where are you going? The conductor voice, flat, professional, built to move people without discussion. Don't wait up. She looks at him for 1 long moment in the doorway of their bedroom on her birthday night, in her blue dress, with the expression of a woman whose body is registering something wrong before her mind has the data to name it. He is out the front door before the expression resolves into a question. Wanda stands in the bedroom alone. The apartment is quiet around her. She looks at the door for a long time. Tony drives through Crown Heights, running stop signs. The story he is telling himself does not hold up to any examination. The indignation of a man who has been conducting a 2-year affair, experiencing for the first time the sensation of being the one deceived. He knows the story is not fair. He knows it even as he is fully living inside it, and knowing it does not slow his foot on the gas. He double parks on Nostrand, goes in fast. Janice sees him first. The shock hits her face before she can manage it. Then alarm. Then the specific shame of being caught in an innocent thing by a man who has no right to catch her in anything, and whose presence here means he left his wife on her birthday to come. And the layers of that are too many to process in the second before he reaches the table. Tony, Calvin is already on his feet, reading the room, both hands up, open, his voice measured, calibrated, the practiced calm of a man who has kept himself alive in more dangerous rooms than this one by keeping his temperature below everyone else's. Relax. Easy. We're just friends. Nothing happened. Let's all just calm. Lee grabs the steak knife off the nearest table. Not a weapon drawn from a plan. An object snatched from a surface. The body resolving its overflow into the first solid thing within reach. Calvin's right hand goes to his waistband. He does not want to pull it. Not here. Not in front of 30 witnesses. but Tony is coming with the knife raised, and Calvin has spent his entire adult life making one calculation correctly, survive the room. The math resolves in less than a second. Three shots, close range. The sound fills the room and empties it simultaneously. Not the clean crack of movie gunfire, but the real sound. The sound that stops everything and fills the silence it creates with something thick and absolute. Tony goes down. Janice is on her knees before anyone else has moved. Both hands find him pressing, pushing. The nursing, training, doing what training does, even when the rest of a person is breaking open. His blood is hot on her palms, and she is saying his name in every register she has. Patoi, English, the dialect that belongs to no country but grief. Tony, Tony, hold on, my de ya, you hear my, hold on, please. He looks at her. His eyes are open and finding her face, and in them is something that is not fear and not quite anger. It is the expression of a man who sees, in the last moment available for seeing, the full shape of everything he chose and everything those choices cost. And he sees it without flinching, without looking away. There is something in that, something Janice will spend years trying to name and never quite reach. The ambulance takes 11 minutes. He is gone before it arrives. Calvin is out the back door before the sirens, on the expressway before the perimeter is established. Efficient in the moment of consequence, built for exactly this geometry, which is the truth about Calvin, that Janice selected not to examine and is examining now on a Crown Heights floor with her hands covered in the blood of the man she loved. The man who called Tony calls Wanda. He doesn't know what else to do. He has her number from a cookout 2 summers ago, and he calls it because someone has to. And it connects on the second ring, and Wanda picks up with the clear, alert voice of a woman who has been sitting awake in a quiet she cannot name since her husband left in a hurry on her birthday. She gets 30 seconds. Her legs give. She goes down on the kitchen floor of the brownstone on Hendrick Street, the floor she has mopped 100 times, the floor her children eat on. The floor where Miss Yvette stands on Sunday mornings, making the whole building smell like home, and she is on it now in the blue birthday dress, saying my husband, my kid's father, to a phone that has gone silent, saying it into the dark of the kitchen. She runs in the building she built, in the life she made. My husband, my kid's father. Miss Yvette comes downstairs, 20 minutes later in her housecoat, and finds her daughter on the floor. She does not ask what happened. She knows the shape of it. She has been watching it assemble itself for 2 years, in the slight wrongness of a smile, in the information offered before anyone asked, in the way a man looks when he is carrying something he cannot put down. She gets down on the kitchen floor with her daughter and holds her there in the dark and says nothing, because there is nothing to say that the night has not already said. Sometimes the only love available is the love that stays on the floor with you. Tony Jr. comes downstairs at 6 in the morning, in his dinosaur pajamas. He stands in the kitchen doorway and looks at his mother and his grandmother on the floor. Mommy, what happened? Wanda lifts her head. Wanda lifts her head. She looks at her son, her husband's patience in a child's face, her husband's eyes looking back at her from a body that has no idea yet what it is going to have to carry, and she pulls him into her arms without a word, because there is no version of the truth a 6-year-old can hold. And so she gives him the only true thing she has left, her arms and her presence, and the fact that she is still here. The conductor gloves are on the nightstand upstairs. He left them there when he dressed for Wanda's birthday dinner. They sit in the early morning light, folded, holding the shape of hands that will not come back to fill them. The leather still smells of rails and cold air and 6 years of the city moving underneath him. In a police precinct interview room in Crown Heights, Janice sits in the clothes she wore to the concert. Her hands are clean now, her memory is not. The room holds the same quiet the last train held the night this started. Fluorescent, cold, patient, not going anywhere. She thinks about the Akamishan saltfish morning, the fried dumplings and the plantain and the coffee in two mugs. She thinks about what she said and what he said and what came after. She thinks about all the versions of that moment, where one of them was different, where he walked back through the door instead of further in, where she let him, where either of them had the courage to name what was happening before it became too costly to name. When the detective comes back with his yellow notepad, she tells him everything, from the beginning, from the last train of the night, all of it without protection, without the careful omissions that kept everything running for 2 years. It is the last thing she can give him. The truth is what both of them owed from the start, what neither of them could offer when it still could have changed the ending. He just needed someone to help off the train. That was all this ever was, at the beginning. One good man, one good deed, one moment where the kindness and the wanting lived in the same hand, and he could not tell them apart, and he did not try, and the train kept moving. The way trains do, carrying its passengers and remembering none of them, running its route through the dark city until the last stop, when the lights go out and everybody has to go home.